People fixing the world.
Hello, I'm William Cramer. I want to start today's programme by playing you a little tape. A few weeks ago, my mum and dad came over to my house with a big stack of photos.
This one was taken. This was the day you did your first steps. And I see you looking very plump and pleased with yourself in the pram.
I hadn't seen some of these photos for ages. They were old and tatty. The colours had completely faded. Some of the photos brought back memories of things from my childhood that I'd completely forgotten.
You're a little bit older here. And
I'm on a sledge.
You're on a sledge.
I really remember that red sledge.
In the snow.
And there were pictures of people who have gone.
Grandad Joe, you loved Grandad Joe. And he made this little go-kart for you. And that's a picture of you and him together. He was a man of few words. He had a big laugh.
All of those photos were stored in family albums, or they were loose in envelopes and shoeboxes. They were faded, and inevitably, a few favourite pictures had got lost.
Recording Granny and Granddad. No, you find Granny and Granddad. I'm just riding a horse, tiny red dad.
By contrast, this much more recent video of my little boy pretending to make a phone call is stored securely on the cloud.
See you, bye, Charlie Chadad.
That is to say, it resides in a rack in a data centre somewhere in the world. Now, this feels like a much better storage solution than a shoebox in my parents' loft. But digital storage isn't perfect. Not only does it cost money and absorb energy, but storage devices wear out, and all of the data has to be migrated to new ones every few years. Because this isn't just about pictures of me or videos of my son. The point is, human beings actually haven't worked out a way to keep anything digital forever. What if something really cataclysmic happened to our planet?
Basically, any trace of our generation is digital. We don't have writings in caves or Rosetta Stones. Everything is digital.
This is Dina Zielinski. We'll be meeting her properly a bit later in the programme.
Imagine the technology fails. I mean, for me, I think about the horror of losing all scientific publications, for example. Most of these are digitally stored, publisher websites. I can't even fathom the idea of having to start from scratch in some cases.
In this programme, I'll be looking at some new ways to store data that could, quite simply, last forever. But there's a second big challenge with data storage, and it's one that we can all relate to. How can we avoid running out? Just consider that since the start of this programme, about 680 million emails have been fired off around the world, and 400,000 hours worth of content has been viewed on Netflix. The market research company IDC has estimated that in 2018, the total amount of data created and replicated around the world was 33 trillion gigabytes, or 33 zettabytes.
It's become untenable, and there's a very good chance that in the next maybe 100 or so years, we could, maybe even sooner, we might run out of data storage devices.
If you are my age, you probably are always going to associate recording and keeping music with magnetic cassette tapes. These are some from my childhood, which I found in the loft. To be honest, I don't really know why I've kept them. But large format magnetic tapes are still being used to store data in data centres. And there's some interesting research going on at the moment that could take this slightly retro storage medium into the future.
Solution one, really, really small magnets.
Digital information is binary, just a series of zeros and ones. Now this translates nicely to magnets, which have a polarity, north or south. Now the smaller that we can make those magnets, the more we can fit onto a piece of tape, or a disk, and the more data we can save. And Nicholas Chilton, a chemist at the University of Manchester in the UK, is trying to make very small magnets indeed. Just 2/1000ths of a millimetre in length.
We're looking to use molecules which are to tiny entities of matter to store bits of binary information. The size of the molecules we're talking about, if we say they're about 2 nanometers, right, that's sort of generous-ish, which would give us about 20,000 gigabytes per square inch. So 20 terabytes per square inch.
Wow.
So that's about 100 times better than existing technologies.
This solution definitely offers great data storage density. The challenge is to get the magnets to keep their memory over time. Think about the hard disk in your computer. The tiny magnetized segments of the disk are sensitive enough, or soft enough, to be written and rewritten fairly easily by your PC. But they're also hard enough to retain their polarity even after you shut down your computer, meaning your data is still there the next time you turn it on. Designing a single molecule that has this ability is hard because molecules move around and vibrate. And when they do that, they can lose their polarity. Now, you can slow that process down by placing them in very cold environments.
So in 93, when these molecules first were discovered, memory was displayed at temperatures about 4 degrees above absolute zero, so 4 Kelvin, which is minus 200 and a lot of degrees, right? So cold. And what we would like to do is obviously move that towards room temperature, right? Where you can make a device that will be able to store information at a very high density for a long time.
Nicholas's approach is to take an atom of the magnetic metal dysprosium and kind of tether it down with carbon rings to stop it vibrating and losing memory.
In 2017, my colleague at the University of Manchester, Dr. David Mills, and his research group prepared a molecule that showed a temperature of magnetic hysteresis of 60 Kelvin.
Which is minus 213 degrees Celsius.
We did some theory to say, maybe how can you improve this? And some other researchers in the UK were able to bring this temperature up to 80.
Are you getting too hot? No, we're not. 80 Kelvin is minus 193 degrees Celsius. So this is still a long way away from room temperature, unless your room is on Uranus. But it's significant because we're now past the freezing point of nitrogen. And liquid nitrogen is not that expensive. Freezing to these temperatures is much more viable, but it's important to note that at this temperature, the magnets don't currently retain their memory for very long, just seconds. And also, there are a lot of technological challenges. For example, no one has yet created the bit of kit that can switch the polarity of individual molecules. But by the time we have that technology, we might have a way around the whole temperature problem.
So there's a radical thought about, well, why don't you just try and put it in a satellite? It's pretty cold in outer space. Could you put, you know, memory banks of memory storage up there and get the cooling of space for free?
So this sort of links us to our next potential solution.
You do not remember me. I am Jor-El. I'm your father.
A clip from the 1978 film Superman. In this scene, our hero has just built his fortress of solitude in the frozen north. This icy palace contains dozens of crystals, which Superman places in tubes to see holographic video messages from his dead dad.
By now you will have reached your 18th year, as it is measured on Earth. By that reckoning, I will have been dead for many thousands of your years.
Now, as it happens, you can now store video messages on glass. In 2019, Warner Brothers teamed up with Microsoft to put a copy of the film Superman onto a piece of glass. The project was a proof of concept for a technology that Microsoft thinks could become mainstream archiving hardware.
Solution 2, everlasting glass.
So if you think of a little slab of glass about 2 millimeters thick, and say like the size of a coaster, you know, let's say 12 square centimeters, that sort of size. What we do is we write data inside the glass.
This is Ant Rostron, Deputy Lab Director at Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK. What he's describing sounds a bit like a square version of a DVD, but it works in quite a different way.
So if you think of things like a DVD or Blu-ray discs, they have a number of layers on the top of the media that you write to, but you don't sort of write in the middle of it. In glass storage, you focus a laser inside the glass, and where you focus the laser, you pulse very short femtosecond pulses into the glass.
What is that? What is a femtosecond laser?
Yeah, it's a femtosecond is 10 to the minus 15th of a second.
Wow. Okay.
So that's 1 quadrillionth or 1 millionth of 1 billionth of a second.
Now, it turns out that when you pulse light that quickly through glass, something rather odd occurs. These minute structures appear within the glass, known as nanogratings. They're smaller than the wavelength of light thrown at them. And to be honest, no one really knows why they appear.
It's like a little iceberg inside the glass. And it has depth and it has orientation. And you can control the depth and you can control the orientation of that little nanograting. And that's how you store data inside.
Think of them as three-dimensional pixels. They can be arranged in separate sectors of a grid, with each grid stacked on top of more grids. The data is read by a special microscope. By adjusting its focus, it reads through this minute rack of data. Nanogratings were first discovered about 20 years ago by Peter Kazansky at the University of Southampton.
The first document which we recorded, I remember, it was in 2014. It was PDF file of our post-deadline paper at Clio conference, at the biggest conference in laser optics. It was the first digital document which we believe will now survive human race. Because, well, if you hit 2,000 degrees, it can decay several hours. But at room temperature, it takes 300 quintillion years. Yeah.
300 quintillion years?
Yeah, there are some assumptions, then you can extrapolate.
But people think of glass as being fragile, that you can drop it and it breaks, it shatters.
Yes.
Isn't there risks that if you write something important onto a piece of glass, you could simply break it and lose the data?
No, obviously it's glass. Glass is fragile. But still, potentially, you know, it's possible to develop bulletproof glasses. So it's possible.
I don't think the idea is for glass storage to get handled a lot, but I can see that some people might like the physicality of this storage medium, in the same way that vinyl records continue to appeal to a group of people who really like to cherish their favourite music. As we've heard, the first document that Peter Kazansky created to outlast the human race was quite a niche paper on optics, but he quickly followed it up with a number of glass discs that contained some of Western civilization's greatest hits: the Magna Carta, Darwin's On the Origin of Species, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Whereas Microsoft has opted for square pieces of glass, some of Peter's discs are round. Over an internet video call, he showed me some of his collection. So you're holding up a piece of glass. It looks like a monocle, but it's smaller. It's just, what is that, 2 centimeters?
Yes, 1 inch.
In diameter?
One inch, yes. Maybe the most important document is it's obviously the Bible, yes? This is Bible.
That's the Bible?
This is the Bible. Initially, we thought to present it to Archbishop of Canterbury, this one. Initially, we thought this one.
Did he not want it?
No, but we didn't manage to contact.
Now, actually, when it comes to file size, the Bible is not that big and not a particular test of this technology. In theory, a piece of this glass the size of a CD could hold 360 terabytes. That's more than 500 times the storage that you get on most laptops nowadays. But a lot more work needs to be done before the technology reaches this capacity. And another big challenge is the writing speed. Peter told me that to match the speed of magnetic tape, it needs to be about 250 times faster. But the fact that Microsoft is actively developing this technology suggests that we may be hearing much more about it in the future.
The thought that in, you know, in a decade or you know, decades time, a lot of the data created in the world would be stored on glass. And I was involved in that journey. That really, really excites me.
But when it comes to novel storage devices, are we missing a solution that's all around us and inside us? Right now, I'm surrounded by thousands of highly efficient storage devices, the plants and wildlife here in my back garden. And encoded securely within the cells of these life forms are instructions on how to grow and live. Of course, this information isn't written in ones and zeros, but in DNA. But nowadays, it's not that hard to translate binary into biological data.
Solution 3. Store files in DNA.
So in order to take a digital file or multiple files represented as zeros and ones, we simply translate them into the DNA alphabet.
This is scientist Dina Zielinski, who we heard from at the start of this program. She works in bioinformatics, a field that bridges biology and computer science.
So just a reminder from, if you haven't thought about DNA since high school biology, DNA's alphabet consists of four letters, A, C, G, and T. In order to convert digital data, we would store anything in your data, in your digital file that is a 00 would be translated to an A. A 01 would then be translated to a C, and so on.
And this is exactly what Zielinski and her colleagues did in 2017 when they encoded a number of notable documents, a classic silent movie, and an Amazon gift card into synthetic DNA in a test tube. Now, this was quite expensive, $7,000 for 2 megabytes of data.
Once we got the tube into the lab, we had to add a little bit of water to it because it was dried, because it's more stable. And then we were able to then sequence it overnight and get our results back the next morning. So the timeline was very quick by DNA standards, but certainly not compared to traditional man-made storage devices.
Nevertheless, DNA has some advantages over man-made storage devices. It lasts a long time. Okay, not 300 quintillion years, but humans have sequenced the remains of a 700,000-year-old horse, which isn't bad. It also feels like human beings will always be able to sequence DNA. The source code of life is not a faddy programming language that's about to become obsolete. If the worst should happen and a meteorite casts humanity back into the Stone Age, you'd hope that eventually we'd figure out how to do it again. But the real trump card with DNA is its storage density.
We could fit all of the data generated around the world in a single day in a sugar cube. That's how dense DNA is. It's about 5 orders of magnitude greater than traditional media. So we're looking at 100,000 times greater. But it's also 5 orders of magnitude more expensive.
The reason it's so expensive is the high cost of DNA synthesis. Dina thinks that's because the DNA offered by synthesis companies is currently higher quality than it needs to be. DNA doesn't need to be flawless for data storage. Nevertheless, some companies are taking quite a different approach. Hyunjin Park is co-founder and CEO of the startup Catalog.
It still costs a lot of money to synthesize each letter of the DNA molecule. So we kind of threw that out in the beginning, and we thought, you know, what is the cheapest and fastest way to create a lot of different molecules, a huge variety of molecules?
Instead of coding binary zeros and ones to A, C, G, and T to create bespoke strands of DNA, Catalog uses 100 pre-existing types of DNA and sticks them together in different combinations, a bit like Lego bricks. Hyunjin says it makes the process faster, cheaper, and more stable. You do lose a bit on capacity, but you could still fit an exabyte of data, equivalent to a whole data center containing 1,000 racks of drives, inside a shoebox. By comparison, Catalogue's new DNA writing machine is quite big.
So I think it's about 3 meters by 3 meters. In essence, it's a huge inkjet printer that takes as input pre-made DNA molecules. It prints them on a rolling substrate. And so this machine has the ability to take 100 different molecules that it takes as input and create billions of different output molecules in the end.
Does the machine have a name?
I don't think we've reached a consensus as a team for a public name yet. There's been a few different pet names for it, but I don't think we'll be able to share that today.
Well, you know, my son reads a lot of Captain Underpants, and everything is something something 2000. So this could be like the DNA, you know, Storage Master 2000, something like that. Whatever it's called, Catalogue says it's hoping to offer a consumer service in about 4 to 5 years. Though their really big bet is on something called DNA computing. This is an emerging field that will basically remove the clunky step of converting back and forth to binary zeros and ones, and instead utilise biological components to run calculations and record and preserve data. Computing and storing information on DNA means that scientists would no longer need to chuck out the vast amounts of data that they collect while they do experiments. Because the problem of data storage isn't so much something that might happen in the future, it's a problem with the way that we're living now, where many of us are forced into making choices about what to keep and not keep. Because actually, we don't know what's important to us until it's important to us.
Oh, yeah. And that was, this is a picture of you with my mum.
I remember that T-shirt,
yeah,
as well.
And you in Grandma's garden, and she's already not looking very well, because I think we came back in August, and I think, was the year she died, wasn't it? I think it was, yeah.
The truth is, we want our data to outlive us, so that it can bring joy and enlightenment to future generations. And all the technologies that we've looked at today could help us do that in the future. That's all for today. Remember, you can download more episodes of People Fixing the World and save them in any format that works for you. If you've enjoyed this foray into the future of digital storage, you might want to check out our recent program about blockchain, which is equally nerdy. Goodbye.
See you bye,
Welcome to Comedians Versus the News,
a brand new podcast where, you guessed it, we're taking on the news. I'm Jess Solomon.
And I'm Emmanuel Husseini,
a Jewish Palestinian Muslim lesbian married couple.
That's right. We're basically a living, breathing current event.
Joined by fellow international comedians.
Get ready for some of the funniest, silliest, and wildest stories from around the world that we've heard each week.
Last month, a pub in outback Queensland has formally banned a group of emus citing inappropriate behavior.
Laughter, energy.
A good time.
Being able to open up a newspaper again.
Without crying.
Comedians Versus the News.
A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
Just search for Comedians Versus the News wherever you get your podcasts.